April 25th, 2016, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration, a conversation about migration and politics at the University of Amsterdam. I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran, and today we keep our eyes focused on the Mediterranean and Europe's troubled efforts to balance humanitarianism and control at the border. Last week, Pope Francis made a compelling gesture on the Greek island of Lesbos. Francis, the unlikely darling of the liberal left, returned to the Vatican with 12 Syrian Muslim asylum seekers, planning to offer them sanctuary, the sanctuary which European governments have been so slow to offer. So has the Pope set us an example for us to follow, or should we see him as but one more cog in the humanitarian industrial complex that has descended on Lesbos in its hour of need? Here to walk us through some of these questions is Anja Carlson-Frank, a senior lecturer at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Hi, Anja.
Hello.
Now, I wanted to start off by just getting some first impressions of what the Pope's just done. What do we make of this gesture? Is it just an exploitative publicity stunt, or, as he has described it in classically scriptural style, is this gesture a drop in the ocean, but after that drop, the ocean will never be the same?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think my take on this, and also, I guess, the take that several of the volunteers in Lesbos that I've talked to over the past week have had, is that if he would have arrived at a different time in Lesbos, if he would have arrived when everyone else was there prior to the EU-Turkey deal, it would have maybe been more of a, I don't know, just another one of the world leaders that wanted to come to Lesbos and show their sympathy. But the fact that he comes after the EU-Turkey deal, I think, tells us something different. And it's also more of a political statement in my reading. I mean, we can all agree that bringing a couple of refugees along is, I mean, it's problematic for several reasons. But in this case, it's also a signal to the European Union from someone who has symbolic, at least, sort of power in the world. So I interpret it slightly differently depending on the timing.
So your take requires, I guess, a more in-depth understanding of Lesbos itself, and your research there hasn't been built on just simply parachuting in and helicoptering out of the island, but by repeatedly returning for extended stays, talking to migrants, to officials, to NGO workers. And so, while for many of us, viewing it from afar, Lesbos seems like an unchanging story of both human misery and state failure, you draw attention to the massive changes in both the crisis and its response.
Yeah, I think we can think about what has been going on in Lesbos and the crisis situation in Lesbos in terms of three kind of phases. The first, starting in the spring of sort of 2015, when number of arrivals were increasing very dramatically, when there was no international presence, no NGOs, very little presence of the UNHCR and so on, and the whole reception of refugees was done by volunteers on the ground who were very pressured by the fact that the Greek economic crisis was going on and they couldn't get enough money from the cash point and so on. Then over as this situation got more and more attention, the whole and there was like a mobilized response from the international community. You kind of move into a second phase where there's a large international presence, lots and lots of NGOs, thousands of volunteers, and you have sort of a whole disaster capitalism developing around this, where you have reception facilities that are built, that are more formalized. You had a large number of buses transporting people to the registration camps and so on. And then you have the third phase, which is sort of past or post the EU-Turkey deal, where you have NATO patrolling outside, you have an attempt to clamp down on all of the border passing that goes on here. You have the detention situation reopened, where they lock people up during the time that they wait for their asylum claims to be processed, and so on. And many of the volunteers have now left the island and are in the mainland instead. So these three phases also show kind of how the response to this crisis outside of Greece and inside of Greece also, for that matter, because there were many Greek volunteers as well, has kind of plays out differently in this particular emergency zone.
In this case, though, the representational politics or the symbolic politics being invoked by the papacy is not too unfamiliar from the sorts of things that you've been observing on a day-to-day basis on Lesbos. It's become a site where people need to both represent themselves as doing good in order to sustain a political project around humanitarian relief. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think also it's important to, I mean, in a lot of the volunteer groups and NGOs, this is a really, really active discussion. There are two things that are like, how do you do this? How do you provide, I think for many of them, it's solidarity work. How do you do solidarity work without actually becoming part of the exploitative structures, right? And how do you negotiate the fact that you have to act within certain boundaries? You have everyone doing work, even though you're just providing food. You then put refugees on a bus and they're shipped to a registration camp or a detention center, which is run by the whole kind of securitized immigration apparatus of the European Union or of Greece itself. And I was at one of the meetings where with one of the volunteer groups, and this was their discussion: should we or should we not distribute food or diapers or clothes inside the kind of facilities that are built to register illegal border crossers, and what's our role in case there is police abuse? This is a very active discussion. I think for research, it raises a lot of questions on how these different interests are negotiated, contested, how they're performed in a very politicized and critical emergency situation.
How did your respondents deal with those sorts of questions? How did they balance their participation on the one hand in providing relief and what ends up being also participation in processes of control, deportation and detention?
I think for many, it's like, because the reality of the situation has been that, I mean, during the colder months, during the winter months, people were dying from hypothermia, right? So if they would not have been people on the beach, I think that's the rationale. If we are not here to provide this, people will die. And I mean, that's also my assessment, that if you wouldn't have had all of these NGOs on the ground doing all of these, or all of the volunteers, I mean, so many people would have come to harm or died, or so many more people would have died, I should perhaps say. And at the same time, I mean, it is harm reduction. It is just doing a little on the side, trying to save whatever you can in a situation where people are brutalized by a system that treats them as illegal border crossers rather than people with legitimate asylum claims. So it is, I mean, and they have the same, my experience is that many of these volunteer groups and NGOs, they had the same type of discussion. And I think that came to a kind of sort of critical point when, after the EU-Turkey deal, when the UNHCR decided to pull out of the detention centers, which I think shows something of that debate. And of course, the refugees also take part in negotiating this. For many of them, the relief was absolutely, I mean, what was provided was absolutely necessary. But there are also examples of refugees who that I spoke to that kind of took the help because it was nice that it was there, and they wanted to kind of, oh, these are so nice people, so we just let them help us. Whereas for some, and for others, it was absolutely necessary, because it was just, I mean, there's no way that they could have managed without the medical help or without the just general humanitarian help.
It would be nice to have you talk a little bit more about that side of the coin, because so far we've been talking about the so-called helpers, the people who are trying to provide some sort of relief. But what role, if any, do those who are supposed to be on the receiving end of aid play in, I mean, the type of relief being afforded and the outcomes on the ground in a place like Lesbos?
in general, I think that the general point of departure is that the outcome of all of this, the outcome of the EU's like highly securitized immigration policies, the outcome of the relief offered and so on, is negotiated kind of or performed like at the intersection of the rules in themselves or the action in itself and those who are subject to it, the actions that they, how they act, how they perceive it and so on. And I think there are so many examples of the way that refugees and migrants actively navigate borders in this way, that they use perhaps a document which is intended to show that they're not welcome as a travel order instead. So they take the administrative deportation order that they have, and during this phase, it becomes a way that they can travel. And the way that they... the use of modern technology, mm-hmm. all of these apps. And I mean, there are so many examples of the way that they are active agents in this. And also there, during several periods in Lesbos, the refugees organized protests. And my sense was when I was, especially during June and July, when there was no infrastructure in place, so many of the refugees I talked to, they were really critical of... at a kind of policy level. It wasn't just the conditions on the ground that they were critical of, the fact that they couldn't shower or that there wasn't enough food or so. It was like there was a very strong sense of entitlement. I have a right to seek asylum. What kind of Europe is this? I thought you were granting human rights and so on. So they staged it. In many occasions, there were protests staged where they demanded registration papers, which is in fact an administrative deportation order, but they demanded better conditions and so on. And that, of course, had a great significance for the way that reception was organized, the way that they had to restructure the camps or things like that. So I think the refugees' actions they're crucial in the way that this played out.
Could you walk us through that first bit a little bit more, where you talked about how the refugees were utilizing deportation orders in order to enhance their mobility or their ability to move on to Athens? This kind of jars with a lot of the ways in which the notion of deportation has been presented to us by theorists, by people like Nicholas Dejanova, who talk about deportability as something that reduces people to an abject status, to being the object of state processes and interventions and control. Whereas you're saying, well, actually, these migrants are utilizing this status to negotiate their own mobility.
Yeah, and I think it's a very interesting case, because what happens when you get into land on Lesbos, when you get onto land, you have to get yourself into the registration camp and you have to be registered in the Eurodac database. Now, during the first phase of this, the registration paper that you get is, effectively it is an administrative deportation order, which either if you're Syrian, it grants you a 6-month provision, whereas if you're from any other country, you have 30 days to leave the country. Now, for the refugees, this is the document that they need in order to buy a ferry ticket to move on to Athens, and then at that time to move up to Idomeni and across the kind of Western Balkan route. So they were aware, many of them, and I interviewed some Syrians here in Sweden now, and they were very aware that it was a deportation paper that they got. Yeah, I got the deportation paper. They can't read it because it's in Greek, but they knew that that's what it was. But I needed it in order to move. So, and that kind of, I think that tells us, and I've just been writing about this, that I think it tells us that we need to view this kind of technology or instrument of state power in a different way, perhaps due to the way that refugees use it or migrants use it more generally. And I think it's very interesting the way that they negotiate their immobility and the way they're immobilized by the system. They have to wait in Lesbos. They have to wait for the papers. They have to wait in Greece and so on. And they use this deportable condition as a way to move. So instead of which deportability, usually the literature on deportability has been very focused on the receiving country context, where it's kind of prohibiting people from staying. Whereas here, the lack of deportability, in one sense, is prohibiting people from moving.
So a lot of what we've been talking about has been about how Europeans and those providing the help are viewing what's going on and how they should deal with some of the moral dilemmas involved. But a lot of your work points us to the perspective of the migrants themselves and how they see processes of humanitarianism and relief. Could you provide us with a sense of what sorts of questions they're asking about these events?
I think for so many of the refugees that I spoke to, this the question for them was often they asked of us to talk about the war in Syria, to talk about ISIS, to talk about Assad, to talk about why they are fleeing. Many of them said, I don't want anything from you. What I want is asylum. I want to be able to stay in a safe place. And for them, many of them were critical of the way that the European Union, where are you human rights? Why am I treated this way? I'm a refugee of war. I have rights, and so on. And for many of them, the focus was on understanding the fact that they were not there to sit in a really appalling refugee camp, but rather to move on to safety. That was what they wanted. And most of the time, the questions that we got related to which country should I go to in order to reunite with my family in the fastest manner, which border is open, where is it easy to cross, and so on. So for them, many of them also expressed, of course, gratitude and said, oh, the Greek people are treating us really well, and all of those things. But for them, it was, at least in my experience, what they want is to move on to safety, and they want to be recognized as refugees rather than as someone who's coming to steal their jobs. Several of them are well aware of the discourses in Europe in general, and several of them said, I'm not here to take your job. I'm here to save my family from getting bombs in their heads.
At the beginning of the podcast, you were saying, well, I kind of give the Pope a pass here, right? In that, okay, done in a way that we're not comfortable with, but the act itself is politically powerful and effective, and we should in some ways applaud it. How should we really interpret this move, given that it seems to me, at least when I first saw it, I thought about, how is this specific group of 12 people taken out of the large numbers on Lesbos? On what terms and on what basis are they being seen as the ones who have the right to be saved as vis-a-vis the others? And how do you navigate us through that sort of complex scenario?
Oh, I think that's really difficult. I mean, that is, of course, there is that element to this. It's like, how have they been selected and on what grounds? And are they particularly vulnerable cases? I don't know the background to that. And I think if we give the Pope the benefit of the doubt here, that this is a kind of civil disobedience type move where you try to deliberately, through one action, violate European immigration policies and the EU-Turkey deal in particular. He's in a position to do that. Who's going to stop the Pope, right? And I think, he is one of the few right now who have really shed light on what goes on. Because now what goes on in these islands, it's kind of out of the spotlight because it's inside the gates. Right, they lock refugees up and they hold them for now. They've actually yesterday or the day before yesterday opened so that people who have been more than 25 days in detention can move around a little bit. But still, I think that is one way which we can look at it. The other way is, of course, to say that to be more critical of that move and say, well, what does that do? But I think we need to look at it in terms of symbolic value rather than actual. Of course, 12, I think it was, right? 12 refugees. It's not going to change the situation. But symbolically, it might actually matter. And it matters, I think, from following all of these Facebook groups and blogs and things of the people on the ground. It matters to them that he came. It matters as in, yeah, someone said something. Not uncritically, of course, because it is. It's also a PR type activity, right? But it's not a very popular one.
No. But to give you a final word, Anya, I'm gonna ask back the question that you posed to me when we first chatted about this issue. So can we help refugees without exploiting them?
I think there's a short and long answer. The short answer is, I don't know. The longer version of that is, of course, without disregarding the great contribution that a lot of these volunteers and a lot of the other refugees also have done to help people who are in a very vulnerable position, and the help is absolutely necessary to sustain health and life along these refugee routes. I think it is very difficult today to operate this type of activity without actually participating in the securitization of migration and migrants themselves. The way that these systems are set up, what you end up doing is harm reduction in a way. Not insignificant in any way, but it is very difficult to operate outside of the system.
Well, thanks, Anya. For those of you interested in finding more about Anya's research, you can go to her staff page at the University of Gothenburg. Monday Morning Meetings on Migration is a podcast run by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can access us at our blog, 4mpodcast.com, and through iTunes. You can also sign up for updates through our Twitter and Facebook accounts. And if you have suggestions about a story you'd like us to feature, or would like to post an audio rejoinder to something that has been said on a previous podcast, please send us an email at imes@uva.nl.